Have one.
Okay. That's a hard act to follow, but we'll give you the opportunity. Let's read item 429, please.
Accept the State of Housing in Portland 2015 report.
Commissioner Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that this is Housing Bureau Director Tracy Manning's farewell performance in front of council today. Tracy has led the Bureau for nearly 4 years, and she is leaving us for new adventures, and we certainly wish her well. She's been an exemplary director, and she will truly be missed. So thank you, Tracy.
Dan, a question. Does she need council approval to put in this?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're going to agree to that.
I don't think we can stop her. And now a bit about why we're here today. This is the first annual State of the Housing Report. It's a comprehensive, data-rich source looking at the housing market in Portland and integrating the most recent, and I should say reliable, public and private data that is available. And quite frankly, it paints a pretty stark picture for many of our fellow Portlanders trying to buy or rent in the city of Portland. The average Black or Native American family in Portland, simply put, cannot afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in our city. Many portions of our city that were once affordable to the average family, Portland family, are no longer affordable. So it's rich in data, but it's also sobering in its message. And I hope that we will all, as a result of this report, rededicate ourselves to increasing the supply of affordable housing and continuing to help those who are most vulnerable to changes in our economic climate. As I said, this report is rich in other data. And on Housing Bureau programming, its affordable housing portfolio, expenditures related to affordable housing, and we will be seeking council and community feedback on this report to help make sure that it becomes, as I said, it will become a regular occurrence in October of each year that we will present this report. So we're presenting it to you now in April, but we will be doing a supplement to this and getting it on a regular October cycle. And it will also become more or less the vehicle for which many of the reports that the Portland Housing Bureau is required by one council ordinance or another to submit to council, we will try to get those all incorporated into one comprehensive report that you, such as you have before us now. And so now I'd like to turn it over to Tracy Manning, Matthew Schibold, Policy and Equity Manager, and Martha Calhoun, our Public Information Officer, to present the report.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. And really want to thank Commissioner Salzman for his vision and leadership in making us, setting us on the path for creating what really is this first-of-its-kind report for the City of Portland. And since it's my last council meeting, I hope you'll indulge me just a second to introduce a couple of my staff people that you may not have met before. So Matthew Schibold is our new Equity and Policy Manager, and he really provided the leadership for this report. I have a feeling you're going to be seeing a lot of him. He's outstanding. Please, I hate introducing you to my great staff because I know you will try to steal them for your bureaus. So.
And I've got it too in my office.
Yeah, you know, you get no more. and Martha Calhoun is our public information officer, and pretty much anything that's really well written that you see come out of our bureau, she probably wrote. And then also Antoinette Pietke, who you have seen because she wrote all three of the bureau's three Successful Innovation Fund applications. She's the head of our data team, and it's something that she and I'm really proud of working with her during my time at the Bureau to really have a strong grounding for our policy work in data. And so, Antoinette, would you, and then her data team, so now I'm going to make them, would the data team stand up? They're not all here, but you guys are going to have to indulge me this last time. And then the rest, no, stay standing. And then the rest of the PHB team. Come on. You have to, it's my last day.
Don't be shy.
It's the second last day. You have to. Lisa counts as being part of our team, too. Lisa represents us. So, and I also want to note that there are a number of members of our housing community here with us today who you probably recognize, directors of a lot of the most important housing institutions in our community. So, historically, we've measured the city's impact on housing by reporting on what we have done, how many units we've produced, what we've accomplished with the resources available, who we're serving. But looking back at what has happened has given us only part of the picture. So Commissioner Saltzman recognized that this approach was inadequate in our current market environment that's rapidly changing. It did not serve to inform forward-looking policy and programming. So this report is a snapshot of Portland today, and it's also then a window into the current environment that a housing seeker faces in terms of housing choice. As a snapshot, its remarkable strength is that it is current market data throughout the city. We were purchasing some private market data and blending it with more historic sources to get a current snapshot. There are some limitations to that because it's a point in time. You'll see a couple of anomalies. Why are there so many studios suddenly available in St. John's? Well, a building had opened the day before. So strengths and weaknesses. But overall, just a remarkable set of data we haven't had access to before. So our goal with this report is really to provide the information that the Housing Commissioner and City Council needs to set policy for the City of Portland, and also to understand how your interventions through primarily our Bureau, although also through BPS and others, are impacting that market. It's a look at our city's total housing market by housing type, by geography, and by affordability for different types of Portland households. It also pulls together a variety of housing reports, the Commissioner mentioned, that Council has historically requested, as well as the outcomes of PHB's programming in our development portfolio. So, as you said, this is a phase one. One of the things that Commissioner Saltzman is great about prompting us is to do things quickly, get something, because we knew we needed to make some decisions. Going forward, this provides us an opportunity to get your feedback. And so if you would, as you either listen to us today or talk to people later or peruse the report, think about what would add value for you and what doesn't add value in those things that you would see every year that would help inform decisions. So now we are going to move into a presentation, an overview of what's in the report and how to read it. Some of the slides came directly from our great, are the work of our graphic designer. They're a little blurry when they get blown up to that size, but the whole report for any of you, but certainly for people listening, is available on our website. And with that, I would love to turn it over to Matt for a little bit.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and walk you through the structure of the report really quickly and then answer any questions you may have about it. So the report looks at various housing and household and population indicators at both a citywide level and in 24 neighborhood areas that you see on the slide in front of you. The neighborhood areas were determined in partnership with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and they generally correspond to the neighborhood areas in the Portland plan. The report blends historic data on households and the housing stock along with some current market data on housing production, affordability, and the rental and ownership markets. The data is derived from a number of sources, the Federal Census Bureau, Multnomah County, Metro, the City of Portland, some private market sources as well. One thing we do want to make sure we note is that a lot of these data sources do undercount some of our most vulnerable communities as well as communities of color in Portland, and it's widely acknowledged that a lot of these data sources do. But in order to allow for us to produce an annual report that can be constantly informing and gaining value throughout the years, we thought it important to acknowledge it and try and address those shortcomings, but to use the sources that are available to us because the Bureau doesn't source data itself. The report is divided into five sections, and so we've got the first part, or five parts. The first part is a narrative overview and some contextual information on the data sources as well as our process. The second piece is a citywide analysis, looking at, again, demographic data, the housing stock, as well as affordability across the city. Part three presents a neighborhood profile data summary for each of the 24 neighborhoods, looking at the same kind of information that's in the citywide analysis, where it is available. One piece I'd want to note are there some areas where you see blanks in data, particularly in the demographic section. We reported everything with a 95% confidence level. And when you start to get to some of the subgeographies, some of the data we didn't want to publish because we weren't confident in yet. Part four, as Tracy mentioned, presents information on the historic reporting, the programming and direct expenditure of the City of Portland on homelessness and housing programming, and then part five, comments on the methodology. So at a citywide and a neighborhood level, the first section of analysis is really looking at the demographic data. And the indicators and source data we looked at are the same as the city economist, Josh Harwood, particularly in the report, The Portland Perspective, 50-City Comparison. And as one would expect, we see similar trends in our household profiles, our income profiles, our population changes over the last 15 years. The report then moves into the housing stock and production, where we present a series of data on single-family and multifamily housing units, permitting data, as well as regulated unit from the metro inventory from 2000 up until 2014. And then finally, the report moves into our couple of larger sections, which are the affordability estimates for home ownership and rental ownership. And the affordability estimates have been assessed for the average Portland household, as well as a variety of household types in Portland, to demonstrate how affordability varies by race and ethnicity, income, and household composition. And so one of the things we'd like to take a moment to do for council, as well as members of the public that are watching, is because the affordability estimates are such a large piece of the report, is to walk through how to read and interpret the affordability estimates. And so if you're looking at page 28 in the report or on the slide in front of you, the slide presents kind of the top half of the page in the report. What you see there is, first, it's the household profile that we're using as an example. And in this case, it's a three-person low-income household, so a household that earns 60% of the median family income. And you've got two components to the top half of the rental affordability estimate. On the right-hand side, you see the median income for that particular household type, as well as what would be considered the maximum monthly housing cost that's affordable, so up to 30% of that particular household's income. And on the left, we've mapped the 24 neighborhood areas and highlighted in blue the neighborhoods that are considered affordable for a two-bedroom unit, two-bedroom rental unit. On the lower half of the page and the next slide in the presentation, what you see is each of the 24 neighborhoods, and you see quarter one data from 2015, so as of March of 2015, what the median rents were and vacancy rates for each unit type, so studio, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, and three-bedroom, for each of the neighborhoods. And we went in and assessed which one of these median rents in quarter one would be considered affordable for this particular household typology. And those in green are considered affordable, and those in red are considered not affordable, where the household, if they were to rent at the average market rate, would be paying more than 30%. Moving on to a sample of our ownership affordability profile, I would turn your attention to, in the report, page 51. And what you have, again, it's a very similar structure. In this case, we're using the average single mother household in Portland. And again, on the right-hand side, on the top there, you see that the median income for the average single mother household is $33,772. And thus, the maximum monthly housing would be $844. Again, you see a map of where ownership would be considered affordable in the city. And in this case, again, highlighted in blue, there are two neighborhoods where that would be considered affordable. In the table, what you see, again, similar to the rental affordability profiles, are each of the 24 neighborhoods paired with the 2014 median home sales price in that neighborhood, and then what the monthly homeownership cost, an estimate of what the monthly homeownership cost would be for that particular median home sales price. And then on the far right, again, an indication of whether or not that would be considered affordable by the 30% standard in the different neighborhoods.
Okay, I'm going to walk you through a couple of just an introduction to what we think the report is telling us, and then we'll go through some key findings. So, I mean, really in short, the findings put hard data behind what we, I think, all think we've intuitively observed and understand about the current state of housing in Portland. Certainly, as we would have predicted, it shows that there is currently nowhere in the city that's affordable to an extremely low-income household, those that were we define as one making 30% or less of our area median income. And I apologize to people at home, but if you go to the report, starting on page 26, you can actually quickly flip through the average households and what they can afford. And just looking at these maps is very instructive. And what you see is that for nearly everyone, if you're making a median income, the central city is unaffordable. For communities of color, seniors, and households headed by single mothers, few neighborhoods anywhere are affordable. Some people are already being pushed out of the city altogether. Of course, our analysis currently stops at the city line. One thing that's quite clear from decades of research is that the segregation of households by poverty really has terrible outcomes for families. But every neighborhood is different, and every household is different. The good news is that Portland long ago realized the great value to all of our families in complete neighborhoods, which provide opportunity for quality of life as well as for prosperity. And that we in Portland aren't giving up on a city that can include everyone and where all of our neighborhoods are vibrant and prosperous. So with that introduction, Matt's going to walk us through some of the key findings and then turn it back to me to wrap up.
So as Commissioner Saltzman acknowledged, this is a fairly dense report, but we did want to pull out some key findings that we thought would be nice to highlight during the presentation, but also encourage that there are a lot more findings in there as folks have time to read through. The first one we wanted to comment on is the multifamily permitting and production in the city. Increasingly, as folks would probably guess, the permitting is multifamily in the city, and in pretty close alignment with what the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has been planning for in a lot of our corridors and within the central city. In 2014, production still had not yet reached pre-recessionary levels, and we measured production by active housing units on the market. But permitting, for the first time, far exceeded in 2014 the pre-recessionary levels, and anticipating that those move to production, including those under construction right now, 2015 may see more multifamily units come online than we've seen before. Production continues to be concentrated in the central city, but also northwest, the interstate corridor, Belmont-Hawthorne Division, and the St. John's neighborhood. Moving to income, broadly across the board, we saw that we know housing affordability is as much of an income issue as a housing cost issue. Martha, can you? And we did see dips across the board in the median income when you look at it by race, ethnicity, for Portland, the Portland population. What we are seeing in our 2013 one-year estimates is we're starting to see those median incomes kind of tick back up. But unfortunately, the trend doesn't seem to correspond to our communities of color, who are seeing their inflation-adjusted incomes continue to fall. And this obviously exacerbates the issue on housing affordability for communities of color, as well as those households such as seniors that find themselves on fixed incomes. If you look at some trends in diversity in the city, what we see is that Generally, the city's racial composition is slowly changing, but not substantially over the last 10 years. But the migration and settlement within the city has dramatically changed. And so the chart you see in front of you demonstrates the change in diversity in terms of the overall percentage of communities of color in each neighborhood over the last 14 years, so since the year 2000. And as you can see, and this speaks to the North and Northeast Housing Initiative presentation that you all saw in January, communities of color are moving out of the MLK Alberta and Interstate Corridor area and increasingly moving to neighborhoods on the outer edge of the city. So overall, this report, and Tracy mentioned this as well, but when you think of this in the context of housing choice, again, households such as single mothers, households from communities of color, and households of seniors continually are struggling with respect to housing choice, particularly when it comes to the central city. There are very few rental units and ownership units available for these households. And for those that choose to live closer toward the central city, they're often paying far above 30% of their incomes in rent.
Okay. And then wrapping it up, we want to talk a bit about the historic policy, some of the reports over time that we've taken a look at. So this is Central City No Net Loss. It's initially passed by council in 2001. The city of Portland will maintain no less than 8,286 rental housing units affordable to households who earn 0 to 60% of the median family income. The city is currently not meeting the Central City No Net Loss goal. As of March, there was a total of 6,818 units affordable at 60% and below. 96% of those units were regulated units, meaning they had some form of public subsidy that kept their rents affordable. Only 267 units that were affordable at 60% and below were free market, market rate, private market, unregulated units. So over time in the central city, while the number of regulated affordable units continues to increase, the central city itself has seen a continued loss of affordability, primarily in the private market units. We've also included in the report the most recent set-aside report, which is one of the other big countings that we do for you. It's through the end of fiscal year 2013-14. It shows that we are meeting the adopted policy goal of an aggregate citywide minimum of 30% of tax increment financing dedicated to affordable housing. We talk a bit about that on page 85 of your report. Thank you. And now he's pointing out to me that I've lost by the end of my talking points. And so what we talking about regulated units is one of the primary ways that we as a city impact the affordability of our housing market. This is a map of all of the regulated units in the city. So what we learn is that investing in housing affordability works. Between 2000 and 2011, the number of regulated affordable housing units in Portland ballooned from 12,800 in 2000 to nearly 20,000 today. And of those regulated units, 65% were funded, at least in part, by the City of Portland. So preserving the city's investment in our affordable housing infrastructure is a cost-effective and vital intervention. The city currently regulates, through the Portland Housing Bureau, over 12,000 units that we have invested in to keep their rents affordable for our citizens. The Bureau currently prioritizes our preservation work, but, I mean, of course, that stock is aging. And so in upcoming reports, the Bureau is going to share more details with Council about your affordable housing infrastructure. So the way, a couple more pieces of information, the way that the city's investment in the preservation and creation of affordable housing is funded is two primary ways. I talk about this during the budget hearing every year. So the first is the federal funding. This chart shows funding over the past little over 10 years. This is all from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for a variety of kinds of affordable housing investments. Community development block grant has dropped quite a bit over time, although it's stabilizing. our next most robust form of subsidy. The home grant has also been dropping and right now has a little less favor in Congress, so we're not as optimistic about that. And then a couple more specialized sources, housing opportunities for people with AIDS, and the emergency solutions grant, which is directed specifically for homeless interventions. You three probably know more about the prospects that we have in Congress than I do, so we'll leave it at that. And then finally, tax increment financing. You know, the reason that we have been able to maintain a lot of the regulated units in the central city. So this chart is a bit psychedelic, but it does a good job of showing what we used to call the TIF cliff, and is was redubbed by our financial analyst as sort of a slow slide. The current years always show this big bubble because we have this this is current development, so you've got 2 and 3 years worth of money going out the door for, you can see the big blip in the River District is the Abigail. It's currently under construction. Convention Center is Miracle Central. So you can see sort of the larger bubbles in the interstate investments, a peak in 2021 you'll know is Parcel 3 in North McAdam. But in general, this represents what you'd see in the Portland Development Commission's forecast of the tax increment financing and the set-aside.
Let me make sure I understand that chart. That is projected spending, not available funds?
Is projected available funds specific to the set-aside.
Okay.
For funds available for the development of affordable housing as currently projected both by PDC and PHB.
Okay.
So it includes recent decisions by council.
Yep.
As you see various districts tail off, that's generally just the end of the district, although a lot of times we have, you know, downtown waterfront ended a number of years ago. We had a recent loan come back in, so we've actually got a little pot of money there. Even though that district is closed, we can continue to spend the proceeds specifically for affordable housing in that urban renewal area. So that's an oversight of a dense report. The next steps, we've talked about this next phase coming up in October, and so we really want to spend some time with you, with your staffs, the stakeholders, many of whom are in this room, to learn what has value. I have no desire to leave to these people a 200-page report that nobody will read. So really thinking about what you want to know, and we'll try to figure out if we can get data good enough to tell you. And so with that, I think we're open for any questions you might have.
Tracy, let me jump in. And I'm sorry there's just three of us today, because this is a milestone, this report. And it is a treasure trove. And so your intent is to do a follow-up with our offices to get some specific feedback about other kinds of data sets, comparators, and at least just put that on your put that out there and get a response from the Bureau.
Absolutely.
So I look forward to doing that because I think you've started at a very high level in terms of the data and the clarity of the presentation. Then we can have a discussion about what else is useful. I had a few little comments that I wanted to share with you today, and we'll follow up. And I'd start on page 94. Actually, let's go to the reports generally, because I think they're really helpful. And that starts at page 84. The no net loss policy and tracking it in the aggregate. The one thing that gets maybe lost in that is, year to year, what units have been preserved and replaced against the tidal wave of market forces that are putting pressure on other regulated units. So I would urge you to at least think about also including a chart about any activity that went against the tide. Because we understand the market forces, but there still might be activity within the district that is consistent with the no net, a preservation or a new unit. As to the policy, could you remind us, does the replacement have to be within the district?
It has to be within the central city. As the policy stands, it's only tracking units within the central city. One of the things I think that's valuable for council to consider is whether this specific way of tracking affordability is the most useful. With this data set, we've got a lot greater ability to track a lot more specifically than we did before. I mean, until this year, we are hand counting these units and then trying to extrapolate a little bit. So I think it's worth considering questions like, you know, sort of where does the replacement occur? What do you want to track? And I think we'll talk to our stakeholders and make some recommendations as well.
And do we think the policy needs to be updated somehow to stay faithful to the goal, but maybe give us more flexibility? That's a question. On page 85, one thing I would suggest in a number of these areas is that at least in the first couple reports, you tell the story as expansively as possible to set the frame. So, for example, we often get people coming to council saying, oh, any given year you're below 30%, you fail. And, of course, the policy is over 5 years, 30%, and it's, you know, it's in the in the aggregate and balanced. And I would encourage us to put that in the key so that people don't just look at 1 year and say, oh, my God, we failed, because, of course, development doesn't happen that way, and we get judged on the basis of 5 years of performance.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And again, on methodology, on page 95, you almost need a PhD to understand the timing issues for the asset portfolio production. And I think that's one that might even benefit from a footnote and a description.
Yeah. We're just going to redo that one.
Yeah, because it's a dynamite document, and it's an important document. But unless you understand all the timing issues of when you credit it, a unit, like the closing of a tax credit program, which could happen actually after the opening, and blah blah blah.
Have the backup for you.
Yeah, it's very hard. So I think that's another example of where more information, so that people don't just draw assumptions from this, because there's a ton of stuff in the pipeline. It's going to hit a certain year, but then you're likely to say average it out, and averaging it out is a more accurate reflection of production. So I offer that. If we could turn to page 20 for a second. It may just be me, but because my eyesight is faltering, I love pie charts. And these are important. I mean, these are great indicators. But 2.2.2 is a really important piece of data. It's almost our baseline. It's the total units you're showing us. And just for people like me, a pie chart sometimes works better than this dense forest of data. Mm-hmm. And it also sometimes, if it's color-coded, it allows you to compare year to year in a way that's very visual. So that might just be the Nick Fish, Commissioner Nick Fish appeal because of his eyesight. I had a question. This tells this contains a treasure trove of data for policymakers, and then has really important information about reporting. Do you foresee a time in the evolution of this where there's some companion data about what our key partners are doing to tell the broader story? So, for example, RESET and all the great work that's happening between the county, the city, and Home Forward. Do you foresee a time when there's a consolidated balance sheet and a consolidated snapshot of production that shows what those three jurisdictions are doing together?
Yeah, I think to some degree that would certainly add value. You know, we don't sort of want it to be a kitchen sink report, but I think one of the things that we wanted to do, and frankly just ran out of time, was to figure out a way that added value, that specifically tagged a home for everyone into where, you know, where does that effort fit here? I think that's just makes sense to most people.
Two other minor things. In page 96, on the homelessness expenditures, just a quick primer. What is the difference between direct and indirect expenditures? Is there a simple dividing line between a direct or an indirect expenditure?
Yeah, I mean, usually direct services are actually going directly to the programs, and the indirect is what it takes to get the program on the street, the money out the door, that sort of thing.
Okay. And then finally, given that you have all this tremendous data by geographic area, is there a way to include opportunity mapping in this report?
Sure.
There's so many of our policies are geared towards privileging opportunity. I just think it's an interesting overlay to look at the snapshot by district and also to have a current opportunity analysis so we can sort of overlay both and get a sense about whether the housing is going in the areas of highest opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also areas of gentrification.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Other questions for the team? I have some further requests, but I might just save them for later. Well, maybe we'll put them on the table now. I think
Matthew's taking notes, so.
Okay. The report's great.
Sure
there's no danger in our
too.
Office that it will go unread because it's already all marked up with highlighters and stickies. So
you can have another one. We have more.
Well, it doesn't have to be pretty. But I guess some specific requests for follow-up in my case. We've spent about $100 million in TIF in the last 4 years on housing. Which is more than the governor is proposing investing in the whole state, which I'm happy about for us, and maybe causes the governor to want to up the game. We're proposing, as your chart shows, to spend about $50 million this year in 15-16. We've just focused our urban renewal area down to 9 urban renewal areas, so we can focus even better. So I really have 3 requests there. I'd like to see a narrative of what you expect the role of housing to be, you know, strategically, not just numerically, but what do we expect the role of housing to be in each of those urban renewal areas? What's the proposed activity for the year, and or how are we doing with respect to that? And then what other plans and strategies elsewhere, not just in the Housing Bureau, what other plans and strategies have to work or need attention in order for that strategy to work? What does PDC need to be doing? What does the Planning Bureau need to be doing? What does VES transportation need to be doing to pave streets where we've got dirt roads and it's pretty hard to develop the housing that's in the plan? So I'd like to hear from not just you, but you as a bureau in particular. So we've got this housing strategy for each urban renewal area. The Housing Bureau has its resources and its responsibilities. It has its partners. But what do other people need to do in either city bureaus or elsewhere in order to make that strategy actually happen, or better yet, outperform our goal? If we did this, we could really do great things. I mean, for one thing, I really appreciate, Tracy, that you've said, you know, we're able to build housing-only projects on Main Streets, but we're not going to do that. We're going to build mixed-use projects because those projects should have ground floor retail in order to have a lively streetscape, not just more units. Thank you. That's the right approach. We should be thinking like one organization, even if we have multiple bureaus. Well, you obviously need some help in order to get those commercial spaces built and managed and, you know, economically successful. So you get the point. But I'd like to see, here's the capsule summary for the Gateway District. Here's what our partners really need to do, and here's what the results should be if all that orchestration comes together. And then, obviously, then what does that mean in terms of TIF expenditure in each of those districts? That's sort of the part you already have. But as the guy who spends the most time here with PDC, I'd really like to have that view of what they need to do to be your effective partner as an organization, you know, for this year and the next 5 years.
That's great. Thank you. I think that's something.
Tracy, Dan and I are going to move a budget note to give you the additional resources
to meet that request.
This has now been transformed to the City of Portland Opportunity Housing Jobs and Transportation.
No, we're trying not to duplicate Josh's report, although I appreciate that note as well, because I think one of the things that we wanted to emphasize in our presentation was just the couple of places that we've sort of started to tag. You know, we want alignment with Josh's report. We want certainly a lot of alignment with the Bureau of Planning, and I think, as you point out, Mayor, obviously very clear alignment with PDC, and I think if that would be my sort of heart's desire, is that in that next each report, that is something we can improve on, is that alignment with the other bureaus.
Tracy, can I add 3 more things?
Absolutely. So far, you've still got another couple of shots at us.
You know, most people who come here give us reports, and they're not read as carefully, so it's a compliment to your team. So page 94 on the tax exemption, you do a separate report on tax exemption every year.
Yes.
And took over that from PDC, and really it's a terrific report. Included in that report is foregone revenue and the accountability piece, the folks that have lost their exemption because they no longer qualify. I would just say consider whether that's useful addition to this, both the foregone revenue so that the reader knows what is the value proposition, and the accountability piece, the number of units in any given year they're disqualified because you're actually scrubbing the numbers to make sure they qualify.
Yeah, no, that's a good idea. We should get that report as part of this.
But you already give us that report, so I was just...
Yeah.
Number two, I'm constantly amazed at how much debate there is in our community about definitions. And I'm not alluding to one person who sends out an email on a daily basis, but more generally to what are the terms that we use? What do they mean? And I, because this is such a valuable education tool, I would urge you to consider a definitions page early on.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
To just in plain English tell your story, so that people then, as they read it, know what we mean by affordable housing or tax increment finance or whatever. Regulated unit, just the basic information. Because I think this is going to have an amazing, a tremendous impact on raising public awareness and understanding. And then finally, I hesitate to open up this scab, but there's another equity piece that we don't really get to here, which is the region. We're half the population of the region and two-thirds of the affordable housing, and that's not sustainable. And at least I would ask you to put on the table the question about whether we should track that annually, because at some point we have to broaden this conversation beyond what Portland and Multnomah do. And we have to stop saying that the regional strategy is handing out the street routes guide to people that are on the street and saying get on the MAX and go downtown. There has to be investment regionally. And I know HUD agrees with that, but we haven't had a systematic planning process to get at the heart of that. And perhaps that's a page that's worth tracking.
Yeah, no, there's a couple of times where either Matt or I mentioned that we suspect one of the things that's happening is people in poverty are sort of falling off the map at the end of the eastern end of Portland city limits. And so we can't get this level of detail countywide, but we can get, you know, the things that you find are add value, so we're not guessing, and we can actually see some of those indicators.
Yeah, I want to second that. That's exacerbated by what the employment trends are and what the housing production trends are, both of which used to be heavily skewed towards the suburbs and now heavily skewed towards the city. So we've got to have that understanding of and progress in what the region does about this, because we simply, no matter what we do, we don't have enough money to solve the region's problem. It remains to be seen whether we're going to be able to solve our own, but we certainly don't have enough money to solve the region's problem. So that's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would urge that future reports track, at least to the extent that we're able, as you pointed out, we don't have the same level of data, but track our situation and what the region's doing and what we're doing, because the knowledge is the first step in that discussion.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, other questions?
Well, we have Sheila Martin from the Institute, PSU's Institute of Metropolitan Studies here today, who can probably help us on that.
Tracking the region?
Yeah, tracking the region. She can help on that, too. Yes.
Okay.
So that completes the presentation. I don't know if we have people signed up.
I think we probably do.
Thank you very much. Like I said, we have some great community partners here today. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see who we have signed up to speak.
We have two people signed up, Kat Guggenauer and Stephen J. Entwistle.
And anyone who else hasn't signed up
Sheila,
is welcome to join.
Are you planning to speak?
She's planning to be available, which is why she's here. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Council and Mayor. My name is Kat Gogenauer. I'm now the newly appointed housing chair for the NAACP, and I've been before you before. So, you know, I'm a very active housing advocate for North and Northeast Portland. I'm a native-born Oregonian, and I did want to say I'm from a very rural part of the state, and so I've only been a part of the Portland community since 2002. Moved into Alberta and Maryland Street at that time, right before the light rail came in. And so a lot of this issue is very close to my heart because my family first had a chance to buy a house on Alberta, Maryland. My youngest brother did. And I hadn't planned to kind of tell some of the lived experience, but I do think there's some importance to kind of understanding what we're dealing with in my area specifically. And his house was foreclosed on in 2010, and my mom and I were made homeless. I had gone to London to study a master's and moved back in 2012, which is when I kind of came onto your radar, as we were looking for houses. So housing and jobs, you know, the kind of idea that an education will help you to pull yourself up and to stabilize your family are very out of reach. I appreciate this report. As I've said before, I also very much appreciate the work of Portland Housing Bureau in leading this data. It's very important, I understand, to have data-driven responses to social problems. And, you know, I do a lot of equity work. I really wanted to appreciate you flagging up the regional issue. I've just completed a 14-month process with Metro working on their equity baseline framework report. And housing equity, transportation equity, these are all, you know, interlinked issues. And so we were very much able to show through a social determinants of health, public health lens, restorative justice approach, how the cost burden, you know, of 30% of income for housing is important. But when you add transportation to that, when you add utilities to that, you know, just the general daily maintenance costs, people are, you know, obviously going deeply into debt if they're able to maintain any kind of housing. I currently live in housing through PCRI, the Portland Community Reinvestment Initiative. I was able to find that data through the state of Oregon. They are a subsidized low-income housing provider. And so I'm very thankful. I know, you know, they came by their housing stock in a very different way. And so it would be great to have more of these CDCs in North Northeast Portland, specifically providing housing for us. There is a lot of talk. I work at Self Enhancement Incorporated. I am the assistant to the president of the company. And, you know, we serve primarily African American clients, and our job has been made much harder. A significant proportion of our people have been moved out. I think that's some of the data I found most kind of striking with PHB's community engagement process, right? We've never been a very significant proportion of the population in Oregon, but if the demographics in Alberta, Albina have gone from 31% to 15%, we do have a population that's highly impacted. So I think with what we know with this data, the kind of coordination with Metro, we have an opportunity to act. This sounds an alarm for some of our most vulnerable community members. We need to couple affordability with opportunity, as was said, and make sure people have a right to return to areas of high opportunity, as well as developing areas we've been pushed out to.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Mayor, council members, my name is Stephen Entwistle, a lifelong resident in Portland, member of Individuals for Justice, and executive director of Oregon Healing Man Sanctuary. I hear the sentiments here. I'm just surprised that we don't have a packed room, okay? This is a real important issue, and it just really surprised that, but, you know, when you have meetings at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, it's hard to get people that are locked into the workday culture to come down and testify. I would suggest maybe getting a little more advertisement out there on these issues, because these are important. That being said, I am also a survivor of foreclosure, having a house in Northeast Portland. And I know what that is like to go through, okay? And that's not fun, okay? Most people don't even survive that issue, okay? And this is going on all the time. Gentrification, it just rolls off lips like it's nothing, You know what gentrification is? It's violent displacement. That's what gentrification is. You're displaced in a violent way. The sheriff will come down and drag you out of the house. Okay? You might be late on a couple of rents, you know, a couple of payments. Now, what's going on in San Francisco as I speak right now? At Hunter's Point in the Mission District. Okay? I don't know if you guys know what's going on there. But I would suggest, and the people in TV land, to take a look at that and to ask themselves in a serious manner if this is what they want here for Portland. You have a lot of gentrification to do. If you want to make your guys' rents and your owners happy, okay, you're going to have to gentrify a whole bunch of people and bring in, recruit a whole bunch of people with money. Okay. I mean, that's what they did down in San Francisco, didn't they? Yeah. So anyway, we need, as a people, we need a rights-based local law making. Okay. And we need to get around the Dillon's rule. Okay. And we need to use eminent domain as a public, as a community, not as a government, but as a community. To get rid of some of these crony landlords and so forth. Okay, I'm serious about this. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog X and also Lightning Housing X. On this data, this report, it's very impressive. I'm going to probably read it 5 times, if not 10 times over. Absolutely amazing. Now, one of the things I guess when I try to look at the overall picture is the shortage of people at 30% MFI or below. I try to look close at the people out on the streets, the people that I think need the housing the most, that the market is missing. I believe that the private developers are doing an outstanding job of 60% MFI and above. We're missing that market 30% and below. We need a catch-up phase. We keep talking a number of 2,500 people currently out on the streets. We need to hit that number somehow, some way. I still want some thought put on that United States Post Office site in the Pearl District for housing 30% and below. It's 13 acres. We need to have a catch-up phase. You're still implementing other plans. They're working. We need to have 1,000-plus people on the streets that'll rotate and not end up becoming chronic homelessness. There needs to be a fine line built into that to hit that right number that's going to rotate. We need to still focus on the tourism dollars, the benefits of having people off the streets into housing, the benefits to the businesses on improved income, the total amount of dollars by having them into housing will be in the millions, if not the hundreds of millions plus by the business revenue, tourism revenue, and the amount of money we have to pay on their health and other expenses. We need to look at the overall production of units currently out there. We need to start utilizing that space more efficiently. If somebody has a subsidized unit that they've had for years and they're not paying rent, would they consider taking someone that they might know off the street into that unit with them at a low cost of, say, $250? What we're doing is we're doubling up certain spaces and utilizing that, and we're also dropping the cost down extensively to get the people off the sidewalks into housing. The cost savings can be tremendous by looking at that, but we all know that we need to develop more units. More units are necessary, but we in the private sector is doing an outstanding job of picking up the remaining units at 60% and above, but that 30% and below is the main focus, and that is the people out on the streets. That is the people in the doorways. That is the people who are lucky to be able to carry a sleeping bag with them. Those are the most vulnerable that need those housing units built. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Anyone else?
I think we had one more person. Yes.
Oh, yep. Come on up, please. Afternoon.
Afternoon, Mayor, Commissioner. My name is John Miller. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Opportunity Network, also a lifelong resident of Portland, and certainly seen lots of changes in Portland. I've known through my work and also just from living in different parts of the city, sort of anecdotally, the changes. What's great about this report is it actually puts numbers to what I've known for a really long time. I feel like this is an extremely valuable report, and I think PHB has done a great job at putting this together. It really highlights a lot of the areas where we've done well and also a lot of the areas where we've got a lot of work to do. One of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about is some of the areas of note, as I read through the report, that really stood out. First of all, it does show to me that there's a fairly adequate amount of workforce housing within the city. There's certainly, when you look at least the average income and the housing supply, other than in the central city, there seems to be enough housing throughout the city for the median income folks. Where you run into trouble is the folks when you get below 60%, especially, there seems to be a great lack of housing. It also shows that poverty has definitely moved east, and that was one of the most remarkable things that I noted, of how drastic the poverty has shifted out east. Some of the points of alarm, it shows that black families and Native American families are priced out of almost every neighborhood in the city, no matter what. They really only have two or three areas that they can reasonably afford. It also shows that our resources really don't match where we need to make investments. So we've got TIF and other things, and those are in certain areas that we actually need to make investments in more areas than just TIF areas in order to make this really an effective a city that everyone can live in. And as a member of the Fair Housing Advisory Committee, I did see a pretty big concern in that just in looking at this, it does look like we're not doing a very good job of affirmatively furthering fair housing. And when you look at the ways the investment or the where people can have access to live and the monies we're getting from the federal government, I guess just I'm just concerned that we might some of the federal funds that we have might be at stake if we don't take some pretty quick action to resolve those things. We also need to look at policies to create more resources and also to build more housing, but also we need to be looking at policies to raise income. I think there's two ways to solve the problem. You can bring up income or you can lower prices, and I think we need to be really making a concerted effort at doing both. Clearly, the private market is not meeting the need, and so definitely applaud Commissioner Saltzman and his effort around incentive zoning. We also look forward to overturning the inclusionary zoning at the state level coming right up. On the resource side, right after this, I'm going across the river to the Welcome Home kickoff, and that is an effort to bring in significant resources to help with this effort to make a lot of those red lines that we see in here, the red percentages turn to green through more resources. So that's, I guess I would find in closing, say that I'm looking forward to working with PHB over the next several months as we move on to phase two of this report. And I just want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, John. Thanks.
Hello. Good afternoon. Diane Lynn, director at Proud Ground. And by the way, the cover of this report is a Proud Ground family, a success story, a beautiful family. And I just want to add just a moment or two additional comments to John. And he said a lot of what many of us feel about the critical importance of this kind of data to drive really good and thoughtful decision-making and policy work. And, of course, as you three know, better than anyone else in the city, we've got to be really creative, innovative, aggressive at what to do around the fact that this city we love so much, and there's a lot of us natives here today, needs to be affordable to groups of people. And remember, the neighborhood grouping that you're looking at is a little different than where a lot of us are used to, and we have to remind people that those are broader neighborhood groups than we're used to looking at, and that a median income means that there are a lot of people below that, a lot of people above that, so there's iterations of the impact around that. I think your points about the regional look is also critical, and actually statewide, because we're finding that in the discussions at the state around inclusionary zoning that workforce housing and lack of inventory is pervasive statewide. So this is really becoming really a crisis on the state level. So we want to, again, I'd like to personally thank Tracy Manning for her extraordinary work and the team for creating really important data that I think all of us are anxious to work with the city on figuring out solutions. Quick final thought, Partners for Affordable Home Ownership is working very hard to partner with the city to come up with, again, ways that we can all work together more efficiently, effectively to create more opportunities on the home.